It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll be talking about farm-to-table eating and how to make artisan-style craft food accessible to everybody. That's coming up in about 10 minutes.
But first, we'll continue our look at a big story happening this week, the sentencing of Bradley Manning, who was charged with leaking classified military information.
We heard the verdict yesterday. Manning was convicted of violating the Espionage Act, but he was acquitted on the big charge, aiding the enemy.
And one question on the table right now. What does this mean for whistleblowers as we go forward?
Joining us now is David Colapinto, General Counsel at the National Whistleblower Center. David, welcome to Central Time.
Right. Good afternoon.
Let's start with your reaction, first of all, to yesterday's verdict.
Well, it's a mixed reaction. Of course, we're a little relieved that the aiding the enemy charge, he was found not guilty on that. But this was a prosecution that has gone way over the top. His conviction on 5 Espionage Act charges he's facing potentially decades of imprisonment for what he has done, and that seems excessive under the circumstances. He pled guilty to what would have the lesser charges that would have resulted up to 20 years imprisonment. And in our view is the case should have ended at that point. What the government has done is overcharged, overreached, and it is not only a threat to other whistleblowers, but also to the First Amendment activities and publishing of the media.
Well, let's look at a would-be whistleblower in the future. They're looking maybe to learn a lesson from what happened, from that verdict. Do you think that people will still step forward knowing what might wait for them?
No, I think that anyone who works within the government is going to be super cautious now about blowing the whistle, even if they do not work in an intelligence agency or in the field of national security. The government is increasingly applying these rules of classified information restrictions to people who work outside of the CIA and NSA in more traditional civil service roles. And so there will be a chilling effect as a result of the Manning case on whistleblowers throughout the government, despite the fact that that Congress enacted reforms to improve or to supposedly make it easier to blow the whistle if you were in the civil service.
Well, was Bradley Manning a special case, though? I mean, he probably knew he was breaking the law. He was releasing things that were clearly classified documents. He'd sworn an oath. Are most whistleblowers in that extremist situation?
No, but what the government's reaction to the Manning case is what is causing the part of the problem here. In reaction to the Manning case, a memorandum was circulated to all executive agencies to be on the lookout for leakers. And who are they classifying as potential future leakers? Anyone in the agency who has submitted a grievance, anyone who has filed a legitimate lawful whistleblower claim, is put on the list of suspects for the next leak. So that in and of itself has a chilling effect throughout the federal government. And again, it is not limited to the National Security Agency or the CIA or other intelligence agencies. This is what is going on throughout the civil service. So that exists. When you add to that the fact that for anyone who works within the intelligence community, there is no place to go in terms of blowing the whistle. There are not effective, safe channels for bringing information forward, and there are no protections against retaliation that are effective and that have the force of law.
Is there a middle road between handing CDs over to WikiLeaks and not saying anything? I mean, can't a would-be whistleblower go to someone in Congress who has classified clearance? Aren't there other avenues to do this short of a massive media release?
Sure, there are. A massive media dump is not something that I think most people would do. But the problem here is that there are on paper places you can go. It has been tried, and it has people who have gone that route themselves have faced prosecution. For example, in the case of Thomas Drake, who worked at the NSA, he went to the Inspector General, and he ended up having to plead guilty and facing a criminal charge in court for mishandling classified information.
Looking more broadly, what is the value of whistleblowers? What do we as a society get from someone within the government, within a government agency, blowing the whistle?
Whistleblowers are trying to correct wrongdoing that is observed in the workplace. And what they're doing is trying to stop violations of law. They're trying to make our society safer. In the private industry, they're protecting taxpayers by blowing the whistle on fraud against the government, fraud against stockholders. And there have been a number of successes, but when we come into the whistleblowing in the government is in the dark ages with respect to accepting whistleblowers and not wanting to be receptive to their disclosures. How is the government going to correct mistakes or catch wrongdoing if they're not going to listen to people who report it?
You mentioned congressional laws geared toward protecting whistleblowers falling short, it appears. Do you think there's enough sympathy in a place like Congress for whistleblowers to try to do more, to try to guarantee their ability to blow the whistle without prosecution?
Well, this is it's kind of a paradox. Congress has been effective in passing a lot of laws to expand protections for employees who work in the private sector. When I first started practicing in this area about 25 years ago, there were virtually no protections for people who worked in corporations. And there were some laws in the states, but at the federal level, unless you worked in a specific industry like nuclear power, there were very few whistleblower protections to protect you federally. That has changed enormously through the False Claims Act, which protects contractors. Now there is a new whistleblower provision that provides rewards under Dodd-Frank. They have strengthened protections for people who blow the whistle on securities problems for regulated companies, publicly traded companies. So the field has shifted, and Congress knows how to pass effective whistleblower laws. So what we find ourselves with is a system where there are increasing protections that effectively provide safe channels for people who work in the private sector, and the people who work in the federal government are left behind. And if you work in the intelligence agency, there are no protections whatsoever. So this imbalance is something that is caused by Congress not willing to take on the tough problems within the federal government when it comes to protecting whistleblowers. They're willing to do it when you're dealing with securities fraud or tax fraud or contracting fraud, but when it comes to misconduct and violations of law within the government, they are not so receptive.
We as citizens and as consumers of the media, what are we going to lose as far as information about our government if this really does have a chilling effect on whistleblowers?
Well, if the sources of information dry up, then the American people are the losers. The American people will not have the right to know about government programs that are wasteful, things that are expensive to the taxpayer, or even illegal conduct like spying on American citizens.
David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was David Colapinto, General Counsel at the National Whistleblower Center.
Coming up next, it's a look at farm-to-table eating and how to make it accessible and affordable. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Gardens across the country are popping right now with fruits and veggies, and that means cooks and restaurants everywhere are doing their best to figure out how to eat it all.
Odessa Piper has been at the forefront of the farm-to-table movement for years. She calls herself a recovering restaurant chef after 30 years working as chef owner at L'Etoile in Madison. Today, she's a consultant and works to connect farmers, educators, and cooks near Boston.
She's in Madison to give the keynote address at the annual Cheese Society Conference and collaborate on a dinner with Chef Tori Miller at L'Etoile. And Odessa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Hi. Glad to be here. Glad to be in Central Time.
It's nice to have you back in Central Time. Mm-hmm. How is it being back in Madison?
Oh, it's just so lovely. I'm just soaking up the summer here, and I can't wait to get at the farmer's market. I told my sister I'm staying with, I'm just going to load your pantry with vegetables. I won't be able to bring everything back to Boston. Coles to Newcastle, you know. We have some good markets out in Boston, too.
Nice. Well, I was going to ask if you're going to hit up the farmer's market, so it's too irresistible to stay away from.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, and there's lots of things that actually aren't so perishable. I mean, there's sorghum and hickory nuts, and I'm really excited to see if any ground cherries are being harvested yet. And I heard a rumor that Harmony Valley Farm might be growing chervil root this year, though that won't be coming in probably until October.
Odessa, how important are farmers markets like the one here in Dane County or around the state in connecting consumers with the farm?
Well, you know what's interesting is, of course, our Dane County Farmers Market is the largest in the country, and so it's kind of uniquely spectacular. But it's been very exciting to be out in Boston and actually going into the smaller old neighborhoods of Boston and seeing smaller farmers markets there. And I think that they have a very important role in connecting with, you know, civilians, as we like to call them, just, you know, regular folks, with the kind of access to fresh produce. And I think one of the things that farmers markets are so important for is putting a face behind the food and educating the eater. And so these exchanges are happening even on relatively small farmers markets, like the one in this little neighborhood of Roslindale that I live in Boston.
Well, you're here to give the keynote address at the annual Cheese Society Conference. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with the Cheese Society?
Well, they're some of my favorite people in the world, cheesemakers. I think maybe it's because of the animals that they work with, but they have the greatest sense of humor of any artisan I know. So it's going to be a little bit like going to heaven for me. This is an organization that really has a pretty wide swath of producers, from really large multi-state producers like Organic Valley, to very small artisan producers that, you know, maybe their cheese never even makes it out of a 50-mile radius. And so it's also the food writers, people in media and advertising and packaging. I mean, so it's a lot of aspects of the industry, not just the cheese room. You know, it's also the cheesemongers, the people who ripen the cheese and sell it and retail it. So I like that. You know, it's takes a village to make and sell and educate on about a piece of cheese.
And I love one of the things I read about you recently that said that you used to cook with USDA cheese that was sort of more one size fits all, but that now you were one of the first people who said cheeses had a voice. I love the idea of a cheese having a voice.
Well, I have to give credit for that to a friend of mine, Ed Janis, who was we were chatting about it, but he said that, and I asked him if I could use that phrase, because I do think it is it's a very good way of you know, cheeses, that expression goût de terroir, it means the taste of place, it's in French. And so, you know, you have so much of what cheese is communicating is in your mouth, and both, you know, going down, but the praise of it coming back up, there's the voice.
Odessa, I think a lot of people hear about artisan-style food and local and farm-to-table and think, that sounds expensive. I hold in my hand a new chapbook you have out, The Market Kitchen. It's a chapbook of recipes and thrift for the home kitchen. I wanted to key in on the word thrift. Can we eat this way cheap?
Well, this is the beautiful thing about being patient as regards sustainable agriculture kind of coming online in the United States, starting with the Back to the Land movement in the 60s, the infrastructure wasn't there, and so this food tended to be more expensive because we were having to pay for the infrastructure, you know, the trucking and the distribution and just all of these hidden elements that help make the connection. But I think that because we have more and more small local producers sort of infill, so to speak, that the price is actually going down. And it's not that the farmer is making less. It's just that the whole investment is starting to reach a critical mass. So I was just telling a friend the other day, I was just noticing, like even in Madison, you can't go anywhere without encountering, delicious, local, artisanal, well-prepared food at every price level, from the most casual cafe to, fine dining. And this has always been the goal, believe me. And if I could add to that, in Roslindale, which is a very working-class neighborhood of Boston where I live, our farmers market is not posh. We've got a huge number of folks there that are using the SNAP program, which is sort of a double dollars program for that the government sponsors for families, lower-income families. But there are all sorts of folks at this farmers market at every income level, and that's really a beautiful thing when you see that it's not just stratified with one part of society, that we all love wholesome food and we all know why it's important.
Well, in this book that Rob was talking about, you give some recipes for people, and one of them that struck us is a pizza salad. Now, everyone who works kind of later end like Rob and I do, you get home and sometimes you're just too tired to cook, and so you reach for the frozen pizza, which is okay, but you have a way to kind of freshen that up.
Exactly, and I kind of liked the shock value of making sure that folks knew that Odessa, the owner of L'Etoile, actually would work with commercial frozen pizzas. I think they're marvelous. I think they're one of the best inventions ever, because I would just pop one in the toaster oven when I'd get home, exhausted from a day or an evening of work, a hard day's night, and I would just start slicing and dicing vegetables that I had brought from the farmer's market that day. And while the pizza was baking, I'd grate up some cheese or thinly slice some squash or eggplant on the mandolin and chop up some herbs. And as the pizza was baking, I would just slip it out of the toaster oven, put some toppings on, put it back in, chop up some more, take the pizza out, put some more toppings on until I finally got the cheese, and then put it back in. And because it was, would be cooking as I was adding the toppings, and because I was desperately hungry, it still would, be ready in about 15 minutes, which was about all my appetite, could bear waiting. And so I even realized that, if you're really ravenous, you can burn your mouth on the hot cheese. So I would make a salad and I would take the pizza and snip it with a scissors, just snip kind of crouton-sized pieces right into a really nice, sharp salad of a peppery salad of arugula and whole basil leaves, and toss the pizza croutons through, and it would get a little messy and gooey, but the salad would cool down the pizza to where I could eat it, and I noticed that all this pizza happiness would coat the greens and make them delicious. And I had some nephews over once and tried it out on them, and they had declared to me that they would never let any kind of green leaf enter their mouth, but they were actually digging after the salad because it kind of flavored like pizza, and they liked that.
I love this philosophy, because if I get some fancy ingredient, I feel like a lot of pressure, like I've got to make some elaborate dish with it, and then it just goes bad before I use it. But we can take that funky stuff and put it on a delivery vehicle like frozen pizza and still get a lot out of it.
Mm-hmm. And I think some other recipes in the chapbook, which is a very slender volume, I have to say, but it's some favorite recipes. And one of the things I do towards the back of it is tell a story of how I found myself in possession of about 75 gallons of beautiful fresh cider, and I reduced it the way the Amish did to it was a syrup so I could store it. And then I came up with like a bazillion different ways to use this incredibly delicious cider syrup. And so the idea is that we can put things by, and like beautiful, expensive, delicious, fragile summer raspberries or currants or strawberries, rather than let them go bad, pop them in the freezer. Just let them get a mix of peach slices and raspberries and black currants, whatever you want. Mix them up in your little freezer bag, and then in February, bring that bag of fruit out and maybe make add it with some apples to make a really yummy fruit crisp.
Well, Odessa, thank you so much for all of the inspiration today. We appreciate having you on.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Odessa Piper is a James Beard Award-winning chef, and she was co-owner of L'Etoile, or owner, I should say, of L'Etoile in Madison for 30 years. She's back in town today.
Coming up tomorrow in Central Time, the first same-sex marriages are taking place this week in Minnesota. We'll hear what's going on with our neighbors to the west.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later on in the program, we'll get an update on the efforts to kick off peace talks between Israel and Palestine and check on the progress that's being made.
And here's something going on. We saw in the news today, it is J.K. Rowling's birthday.
Rowling, I think.
Yeah, I never know.
Colin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it's Rowling.
And we're wondering, we're going to put this up on our Facebook page, the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have a favorite character from the Harry Potter books or movies, or a favorite actor who plays one of the characters? Central Time Facebook page. My kids, Veronica, tend to go for the animals. The owl, Hedwig, has always been a favorite of theirs.
They go for the animals. I actually am a Ron Weasley devotee because he's got a sense of humor. I like the actor who plays him. Harry's kind of serious for me. I like that Ron has a sense of humor.
You know, I didn't think I had an answer to this, but I do. Hermione Granger, and I'll tell you why. Unlike Harry, who, you know, went through some hard times, but he was born with all this power and he keeps getting stuff. Hermione had to work at everything she got. She got powerful and whatnot because she did her work.
You have a virtuous answer. And I have a shallow answer. I like Hermione, too. And I also like that she's the girl. And half the time, 75% of the time, it's actually Hermione who saves the day. And some people actually, you know, just to raise a critique here while we're talking about it, said that, you know, why wasn't Hermione the real star of these books?
I saw a piece on that somebody wrote some time ago. Anyhow, you can go over to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us about your favorite Harry Potter character, your favorite Harry Potter memory.
And if it's been something that you and your kids have been reading together, and lots of people have shared it, and it's been meaningful for people over the years. We read it out loud. You know, actually, my husband read it out loud to me. I'll admit that. And it was a fun thing to do. They read really loud out well. So we'd love to hear your stories on Facebook about your Harry Potter memories as we observe J.K. Rowling's birthday.
We'll check in with what you had to say later. But first, we're going to return to the issue of domestic surveillance. When the PRISM program was brought to light about 2 months ago by Edward Snowden, tech companies like Facebook, Apple, and Microsoft were named as participants, allegedly providing the NSA with electronic communication records.
And while many of these companies reacted with surprise or silence, our next guest says these reactions are actually drowning out a larger truth.
That truth, he says, is that those private tech sector companies effectively built what we're seeing in the surveillance system, and they got rich doing it.
Michael Hirsch is chief correspondent at National Journal, and his piece, How America's Top Tech Companies Created the Surveillance State, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, you know, you've written about this as a long story that's been a long time coming. Let's get some background information. How long has this relationship between tech companies and the federal government been going on?
Well, I mean, originally it began just after World War II. There was a program called Shamrock by which the government and the predecessor agency of the NSA, which wasn't created until 1954, were reading telegraphs that were leaving the country. And this went on for decades until the 1970s when it was exposed and caused a big hoopla at the time, which was kind of an earlier iteration of what we're seeing now. That actually is what led to the creation of the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The latest chapter really began in the 1990s when Silicon Valley was emerging, and the NSA found that it was really behind the times in a lot of these new technologies as the Internet became prevalent and, PCs were being used. And they realized that the threat was no longer a single state like the Soviet Union, which the NSA was basically created to monitor, but instead multiple lone terrorists or terrorist groups that would communicate around the world using cell phones or computers. And the NSA realized it had to get up to speed, and the only way of doing that was really to bring in the private sector, the tech and telecom companies. And they did that using a lot of implicit leverage that the public doesn't realize that they had, in terms of the NSA had basically veto power over many of the telecom mergers that were occurring then. The NSA also had a kind of veto power over the lifting of export controls on encryption, which was a big debate issue back then.
So, now, when you're talking about leverage, you make it sound like there's some coercion involved, that the government kind of had to twist some arms to get cooperation.
I think that that is what happened, although I don't think it was always overt. But what happened was the tech companies and the telecom companies realized that they needed NSA approval, and they sat down at the table, and they began to cooperate with the government. At the same time, because the NSA was so far behind in technology, bear in mind that during the Cold War, the NSA was the agency, and the other intelligence agencies actually built many of the technologies that they used to monitor. By the time the Internet era came around, again, these technologies were in the private sector. So the NSA basically privatized itself. It created most of the surveillance technologies using private sector technology. In fact, the former director of the NSA, Michael Hayden, told me for this article that there's not a computer or telecommunications system at Fort Meade, which is NSA headquarters, that the government still owns. They're basically all privately built. So the entire surveillance system is really something that the private sector has created.
Now, it's interesting because that kind of flies in the face with what, as a citizen, you know, most of us assume about these private companies, emphasis on private. You're talking about Yahoo, Microsoft, Tumblr, you know, a whole bunch of them, Facebook. And we assume that these are privately held companies and that they're very separate and distinct from the United States government. I mean, we've been getting some cracks in that facade, obviously, with the PRISM program. But I guess, you know, are you saying here that this has been almost a partnership, or is that too strong a word?
It has been a partnership. It's important to distinguish between companies, the giant Internet companies that we know so well, Google and Facebook, which have allowed their servers to be used by the government, and many other tech companies that are involved in actually building the system. But they're all part of the private sector. I mean, we have a number of companies like Booz Allen Hamilton, a giant government consultancy, that have grown rich on building these surveillance technologies, others that are in Silicon Valley, like Palantir Technologies, that have also developed a lot of these systems. And the systems that are being tapped now as part of the surveillance system, you know, the Facebook servers, the Google servers, as well as the telecoms companies. So those companies have cooperated, not always willingly, and I think in some cases their cooperation has been forced. And then many other tech companies that have been only too happy to take part because, you know, these are rich, fat government contracts.
Well, now that this is coming to light in the public eye, how comfortable do you think that these companies are with being seen as being partners with the government in surveillance?
I think, you know, especially when it comes to the giant brand name Internet companies, you know, Facebook and Yahoo and Google and other famous companies, they're very uncomfortable because, you know, they feel their brands are being besmirched. They don't like the image of the people thinking that they're in bed with the government when it comes to spying. And that's why what you're seeing now in recent weeks is an effort by these companies to push the government to allow them to talk about the kinds of requests they get through the FISA court.
Now, what good does that do them? What good does that do them?
Well, I think what they're trying to show is that their cooperation is not complete, that, you know, that there are some limits to what they allow the government to do in terms of whether the government is allowed to tap directly into their servers. Some of them are saying, you know, that's not really the case. We've negotiated an agreement with the government whereby the government asks us to impart some of this data and put it into a separate database. And there's some question about what the government owns that and how much the government is allowed to see. We don't actually know the answers to those questions just yet because these companies have until now been prevented by law from divulging these requests. But that's the kind of public pressure you're seeing. And when you combine that with what's happening on Capitol Hill now, where a lot of people in Congress on both sides of the aisle are trying to push for more transparency in these programs, I think what you're seeing here is the building up of a real groundswell of pressure, both from the private sector that's been involved in these surveillance programs and from the Congress that feels that it hasn't been getting enough information about the way these searches are conducted. So I think that's not going to go away. I think it's going to continue to build.
Now, so there are these awkward questions for these companies about how complicit they've been in working with the government to develop these surveillance programs. On the other hand, are there going to be even more uncomfortable questions down the road about whether they have unfairly profited by being involved in this relationship?
I think that there probably will be. In the immediate aftermath of the revelations by Edward Snowden, the leaker at the NSA, there were some news reports by me and others about just how much money Booz Allen Hamilton makes the NSA. I mean, most of the contracts they get are from the NSA. So I think that, the main thrust here is to say, look, everyone sees the NSA as this sort of big brother type agency spying on everyone. But in fact, the best and brightest of the U.S. private sector, tech and telecom companies, have been very involved for a long time, a lot longer than people realize.
Well, we're talking right now to Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent at National Journal, talking about his piece, How America's Top Tech Companies Created the Surveillance State.
You can join in with your questions and your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. Is there a company involved in these things that you wanted to ask about? Do you think that it's okay? You don't mind that companies are working with the government on what might be a reasonable project, something that they should be doing? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're continuing our conversation now with Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent at National Journal, about his piece, How America's Top Tech Companies Created the Surveillance State.
And we want to know what you think about what you're hearing or your questions. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this kind of cooperation between the high-tech companies that make a lot of what goes into the internet or companies that we see every day, Facebook, Google, sharing information with the NSA? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Now, Michael, when Snowden released his information and we first got, a whiff of PRISM and what the government was up to in terms of surveillance, there was kind of this pregnant pause, I think, where a lot of us were sort of waiting to see what's the reaction going to be. How big is it going to be? How much are people going to care? And so far, I mean, the Snowden story has been fascinating, but people seem to sort of think this is unfortunate, but maybe it's the cost of what it's doing. I haven't seen a lot of passion around this topic. What do you think?
Well, that's been really interesting, actually, because you're right. You're absolutely right. In the weeks right after the Snowden revelations, there didn't seem to be a big shift in public opinion. It seemed like that what Snowden was trying to do, which was to awaken outrage, was not working. And a lot of the public is still, I think, basically okay with the idea of this type of surveillance. You have to remember, over the last 10 or 15 years, people have been giving up a lot of privacy. Every time you go on the internet and do a search, the information is recorded by Google and other companies, and information is passed on to corporations that then, advertise, do direct advertising to you based on whatever your desires or wants are. Every time you go through Easy Pass, with your car, your travel movements are recorded. And so I think, in light of that, the whole concept of privacy has shrunk to some degree. And so I think that's one reason why people have had a sort of complacent attitude toward this. But at the same time, we see a big shift, on Capitol Hill. A number of congressmen, there was in the House in particular, say that, when they've gone back to meet their constituents, they've heard a lot of complaints about these programs, and concerned that they're not being sufficiently monitored by the government. And last Wednesday, there was a remarkably close vote in the House on an amendment that would have basically shut down the NSA program. The amendment failed to pass by only 7 votes. So clearly, I think as the public digests this news, there is some growing concern. And I think as a result of that, we are going to see changes in the FISA law. You have even senators and congressmen that are defending the NSA surveillance program are saying that there needs to be more disclosure of these requests for information.
Where's the shift coming from if it's tending toward being a little more upset about this? Is it coming from Congress itself, or is it coming from the public?
That's a good question. The polls do show some shift against the program. Majority of people who've been polled in recent polls, for example, the Washington Post ABC poll that just came out, say that they suspect more of their information is going to the government and might be being abused than they would want. At the same time, you see the public, by a bare majority, I think, still saying they're okay with the NSA doing this kind of surveillance. And I think as people understand what was going on here, that in fact this was intended to be a program to basically ferret out terrorists and terrorist cells that might be using internet communications, and that most of those communications, 60-70% of it, go through U.S. servers, even if it's abroad, that the NSA, you know, doesn't really have much choice. I mean, the nature of the threat is the same. It's very dispersed. You have, you know, lone terrorists like the Boston Marathon bombers who could come out of anywhere using these technologies, namely computers and cell phones, to communicate. And if there is a successful terrorist plot and the NSA doesn't detect it in the future because these programs are shut down, I think you're going to see a reckoning of the kind we saw after 9/11. It's important to recall that right after 9/11, when the House and Senate Intelligence Committees came out with their reports in 2002, they harshly criticized the NSA for being behind on technology. They even criticized the NSA for not doing more domestic surveillance. That was in the report, and the report was signed off on by, you know, some senators that are now chief critics, like Ron Wyden of Oregon. So the NSA was basically pushed in the direction of doing this kind of surveillance, and the question now is, did they go too far?
Well, let's go to the phones now. We've got Kyle on the line from Waukesha. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. I just started listening to your program, so I'm sure there's other things that have been said. But what I told the person who screened the phone call is I'm more afraid of private corporations and or entities performing than if they get intertwined with the government. You know, the government has established and known requirements and procedures, processes that have to be followed. And when they're not, there's a clear cut. This is what's going on. This is where you broke the line. And the CIA, for instance, has consistently purchased for hire personnel, became private companies. And now the CIA is not responsible for what happened, even though they might have nudged the private entity into a certain action. They can say legally, we didn't do this. And there needs to be a lot more government oversight on this, even if they have a secret committee, but something that when it passes this line, it gets released to public.
And what do you think about that, Michael? Is Kyle right? Yeah. Is there oversight? Does the government have oversight on these companies?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what is at issue now, what's being debated in the Congress in terms of new types of laws. It's not so much direct oversight of the companies because, you know, let's bear in mind that even though the companies built the surveillance state in effect, it's all been done through government contracts, through government say-so. It's really more of a question of whether in essentially collecting all of the telephone data of U.S. citizens, which is what the NSA has been doing, they went outside the intent of the FISA law, which was supposed to restrict their searches to, you know, specific terrorist-related or you know, investigations related to suspicious characters. And this is what you're going to see, I think, coming out of all these legislative efforts in the Congress. I think there's going to have to be more disclosure of the specific requests that the FISA court makes to the companies, which is what the companies themselves are calling for now. And I think you're going to see an amended FISA Act that, in effect, will put more checks not just on what the government does, but what on the companies do, as the caller was suggesting.
So that's what you're seeing for down the road.
Yeah, I think we're going to see this, you know, over the next few months. This is not going to go away. Congress is about to go into recess, but I think they're going to pick this up again when they come back in September.
And what about the American public? Have we finished having this conversation, I guess, among ourselves about whether, you know, we prefer patriotism or, you know, security and privacy?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's one of those debates that goes on, that is a constant, you know, tightrope walk, if you will, between protecting privacy, protecting individual rights, which everyone is concerned about, but also what most people, certainly people in Congress, think of as an essential function of government, which is to protect our safety. And, of course, the argument of the NSA, and you see this, you know, leading senators like Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, who's the chairwoman of the Intelligence Committee, along with leading Republicans, say that they believe that this program is necessary, as does President Obama. So I do think you're going to see this NSA surveillance system survive, as I say, the, you know, what I call it, the intelligence industrial complex, which is a little bit scary, but I think that that's not going to go away. But I do think inevitably, as we've seen in past discussions about FISA going back to the to the original act in 1978, there's going to be an intense debate over whether or not there's enough disclosure. And what you're seeing Congress pushing for now is, we want more of us to know about this program. We want to know more about specific requests through this program, and we want to know exactly what the NSA is doing. We're not always going to be disclosing it. A lot of it's going to continue to be classified, but we think that the information should be more widely circulated and debated, at least within the Congress.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael Hirsch is chief correspondent at National Journal. His piece, How America's Top Tech Companies Created the Surveillance State, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, earlier on in the show, we asked for your comments, J.K. Rowling, or Rowling's birthday, and maybe you can comment on that, on the Central Time Facebook page. Who are your favorite Harry Potter characters and why? Eric wrote, one of my favorite Harry Potter characters was Professor Remus Lupin, who was Harry's first real defense of the dark arts professor. It was he who helped Harry realize his power to defeat the Dementors and also gave Harry his first in-depth glimpse into his parents' past, since he was a close personal friend.
And Jake said, I very much enjoyed the Harry Potter books. Now I'm enjoying reading them to my two sons. Mindy says, I'm a huge fan of Dumbledore. I love his wit and his compassion. Plus, he was wise enough to admit that he made mistakes.
And here's Jessica on Facebook writing, I enjoyed reading about anywhere in the Wizarding world that was outside of Hogwarts. It seemed like wizards had such a different way of life than we muggles, and you only got a small sample of it.
Well, we will raise a glass of metaphorical butterbeer in honor of J.K. Rowling's birthday. Happy birthday, and thanks for those great books.
And you can keep sharing your comments at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, we'll get an update on the efforts to have peace talks between Israel and Palestine and see if any progress is being made. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.